you look at Clarence, they've just got a very good, very well communicating team that seems to be able to deliver a huge amount of performance. So I think they'll be very tough to beat.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. As we digest the Italian Grand Prix where Max Verstappen unexpectedly ambushed the McLaren drivers, winning from pole position, McLaren could nevertheless be on course to clinch their second F1 Constructors' Championship in a row in Baku next weekend, with seven races of the season to spare, which would be a new record. We've become used to McLaren as the dominant team since last summer, but when that dominance ends, is Ferrari, Mercedes, or Red Bull the most likely team to win? And are there any outsiders who have what it takes? Here with me to discuss this, I'm delighted to welcome back friend of the pod and former Aston Martin technical director and head of aerodynamics at Red Bull, Dan Fallows. How are you doing, Dan?
Very well, thanks, James. Thanks for having me back on again.
Oh, great to see you. Great to see you. And Autosport's F1 writer, Jake Boxall-Legg. How are you doing, Jake?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. Just got back from Monza yesterday, so ready to talk all things Italian Grand Prix and beyond, as is the topic.
Indeed. Well, we'll start then with you with a quick look back at what happened in Monza at the weekend, where Verstappen surprised everyone, except perhaps Red Bull's own advisor, Helmut Marko, it seems, who predicted he might be able to win this race, by outpacing the McLarens. It's not been on the cards for quite a while. Jake, how on earth did they do it?
So I think this is a case of learning a lot from last year. And when you look at last year's Monza race, Red Bull didn't really have a proper Monza spec aero package. I think it was sort of like a spa wing that they'd cut some of the trailing edge out of or something like that, maybe a little bit less simplified than that. But they did have a lot of setup problems last year. So all of that has been learned upon, it's been fixed upon. And I think ever since Laurent Mekies has come into the team as well, there is this suggestion around Red Bull that feedback from Verstappen on the simulator is being valued a little bit more. That Mekies can kind of translate a little bit more, you know, given his background as a former race engineer and that sort of thing. And it just seems to be this kind of perfect storm of things clicking into place a little bit more. There's no longer this kind of disconnect between Verstappen and perhaps the management and perhaps the technical team. There's sort of a harmony brewing there a little bit. The fact that it did trim quite a lot of wing off for the weekend, so it was very, very quick in the straights. I think the underbody as well, they had an update to that, and whether that or not had an influence. Clearly, the car was not losing quite as much time as you would expect through perhaps the Lesmos or the Parabolica when you need quite a lot of load. And per lap, he was about 0.2, 0.3 seconds a lap quicker than Lando Norris. And, you know, we know how good the McLaren is, but it just wasn't quite on that level. So I think it was just this sort of culmination of things clicking into place. Max's brilliance, you know, took the lead on lap four and never looked back. Made the race quite one-dimensional, actually. But I think it was just a case of Red Bull getting everything right on the weekend.
Dan, what do you make of this? I mean, there's a really good article on Autosport by our colleague Ronald Vording coming out of the Italian Grand Prix weekend, analysing the way that Red Bull prepares the weekend under the new team principal, Laurent Mekies. And it seems that the theme is that it's sort of less dominated by feedback from the simulator, which perhaps the team was being led on in the past or in the recent past when it comes to sort of setting the car up at these various different racetracks and more of the collaboration between drivers and engineers. That sounds to me like the old school way of doing it. You know, drivers talk to engineers and they believe each other. What's your read on what's going on here?
So I think there's definitely a reliance on the simulator by a lot of teams now because, you know, there's so little testing and the race weekends are quite often so compressed, I mean, particularly when you get to sprint events. But in this occasion, even so, they are very compressed. It's difficult to get a good read sometimes on a Friday about what's going on. So, you know, teams have invested very heavily in simulation, the driver-in-loop simulators, to try to make sure they get into the race weekend in the best possible shape. The question really is when you get to a track like Monza where it is a balance between, you know, trying to get as much efficiency on the car, but also making sure that your top speed is comparable because, you know, you have to be able to race everybody else. And if you're wildly different to other teams, then you're likely to find yourself in quite a sort of sticky situation. So, you know, the trick is really once you get there on the Friday is to react if you have to. And so you can go and, you know, do as much simulator work pre-session as you like, but if it turns out that on Friday something's not quite as you expected, and that's usually something to do with the, you know, the tires, the grip levels, the, you know, the ambient conditions will mean that things aren't quite as you expected. Then, you know, you have to react to that. And I think that's the bit where the good teams sit round in their debriefs and they, you know, do listen to the drivers. And but they sort of take that along with the data that they have from the simulator. And it's a tricky thing to get right, because if they're completely contradictory, it's very difficult sometimes to then say, okay, well, which direction are we going to go in? Inevitably, if you follow the sort of simulation or the data side of it, the driver will probably say, you know, if it doesn't work out, they say, well, you should have listened to me. And if you listen to the driver, then the driver will say, well, that's not really what I meant. So it is a tricky balance to get right. But I think it is important to listen to the drivers, because they're out there, they're feeling the car, and they can also tell you how it's different from the simulator as well. But yeah, it is a tricky thing to get right. I think maybe at Red Bull, they've just decided, you know, they will listen a little bit more to Max. I think it's easier to say after the event they hit the sweet spot, and they can say, well, that's just because we've got this new system in place. But I mean, you can't argue with the result. It was definitely quite dominant.
It was, and winning by 20 odd seconds, considering they got hammered by, I think, 30 last year in Monza. So it's quite a reversal. Stay with you, Dan. What does this say about the competitive picture in Formula One at the moment? You know, where we're in the last year of this set of regulations, the performance difference between the cars is so small across the field, but the reversal like this can happen, especially on a track, you know, where Max describes his car as a monster last year.
I think we've definitely seen the convergence of performance in qualifying, but what's interesting, some teams that are doing, you know, particularly well at some circuits are maybe struggling a little bit more. And even McLaren, who's fairly dominant, by their standards, maybe struggled a little bit more at Monza. So I think this just highlights with these regulations that, yes, the cars can be quick on a single lap and very close to each other. But it's very, very difficult to get a car which is performant in all the different conditions that you need it to be. And even if you do get a car which is performant everywhere, you take all the downforce off, and then you have this absolute priority on efficiency like you do at Monza, and then the order changes again. So it is very interesting from that point of view. But I think, you know, it's very easy for teams to sort of be self-congratulatory after one event and say, oh, this shows we're making lots of progress. And then you go to the next event and suddenly they don't look so clever. So it's really interesting, but very, very circuit dependent.
Well, with this highly performant car, as you put it, McLaren are now on 617 points, which is 337 ahead of Ferrari, which by my back of an envelope maths means that McLaren will clinch the Constructors' Championship next week in Baku if they outscore Ferrari by 9 points there. Jake, check out my maths there, tell me I'm right. But given they've been outscoring the opposition at over 20 points a race for most of this season, seems to me that makes it pretty likely. What do you make of that?
It's weird that no one in the paddock in Monza at any point mentioned the possibility that the Constructors' Championship was going to be sewn up, because I think we've just kind of accepted it as an inevitability. So apologies, James, I haven't had a chance to work out the maths at all. It's not really sort of figured, I don't think. I think we've just kind of accepted that it will happen at some point, and we've probably had a few other McLaren things to distract us, i.e. Oscar being asked to move aside for Lando and Monza. But it's testament to the strength of this team. It's testament to, I think, all of the changes that needed to kind of happen. I guess the first iteration of them being kind of 2018, 2019, where the team got those Renault engines, realized, okay, actually it's not all of this Honda engine. We're quite far behind with where we need to be with regards to the chassis, and making those steps forward. And then when things started to fall behind at the start of this regulation set, the changes at the start of 2023, that got the ball rolling again for this current domination set that we're seeing. And it's an incredible feat to see where McLaren was at the start of 2023, which was in a little bit of trouble. I think Piastri retired from that Bahrain race very, very early. Norris didn't finish particularly highly. Points were very, very difficult to come by. And now they're leading the world championship at an absolute canter. It's a huge turnaround, isn't it?
Certainly is. Dan, I'd be interested in your thoughts on what we saw, actually, before we move on, just on McLaren doing that switch because Norris had that slow stop. It seemed Piastri was saying, well, hang on a second, I thought we'd discuss this and slow stops weren't a factor. Were you a bit surprised? There's been quite a lot of what should we say, outside noise. Particularly a lot of fans are pretty unhappy about some of these decisions that McLaren make, ostensibly to try and keep things ultra fair. But was the one in Monza to Norris's advantage a surprise to you?
It was, and I wonder whether actually in hindsight they'll go away and think maybe we shouldn't have done that. I mean, it's difficult to know what their sort of internal rules are, but it's I would imagine that's not a scenario they particularly thought was going to happen. They may have discussed, you know, what happens if we get a slow pit stop, but in that circumstances, you know, I mean, particularly when you go racing, there's all kinds of compounding factors, aren't there? And I think that was a particularly stark example of where they materially affected the outcome. And I think that's something they might go away and have a think about afterwards. The difficulty is on the pit wall. At that time, you have to make very quick decisions, and I think that probably seemed like the fairest thing to do at the time. I think it's going to be very difficult for them with the fans going forward if that's something that matters to them, because that's that kind of manufactured outcome to a race is not something that people appreciate. So I wonder whether also that'll become a factor as well. I imagine, you know, Oscar sounded quite sanguine in the car, but I wonder whether he was quite as calm on the inside and whether he was a little bit less circumspect afterwards.
Yeah, because you can quickly convince yourself there's a pattern emerging, can't you? And it's the sort of thing that can lead to the sort of breakup of a driver lineup, because, you know, ultimately when you've got this level of intensity, two drivers within the same team fighting to be the world champion, it's not necessarily a recipe for long-term harmony. Anyway, let's throw it forward now and ask the question, who will win the first post-McLaren Constructors' Championship? We've got this big rule change coming for next season. You can find out a lot more about that by reading Dan on Race Tech and on Substack. He's done some brilliant work on what's coming for 2026. But a new set of regulations offers the chance for a change of the competitive order. But which team is most likely to grasp that opportunity? Let's quickly run through the contenders then, starting with the team that's currently lying second in the standings, Ferrari. Dan, when you look at this Ferrari team, do you see a team poised to take the next step?
It's difficult to say that, isn't it, from the outside, because you sort of see that they are clearly making some progress this season. And I think this is probably true of a lot of other teams. It's difficult a little bit to look at the momentum of this year and translate that into what will happen next year, because teams are having to balance very much what they do this year versus how much effort they put on next year's car. So it's easy to look at Ferrari and say, well, yes, okay, they're making some progress, but is it enough? It doesn't look as though they're ready to make that next step. But we genuinely don't know how much effort they've put into next year. I think what I would tend to look at is, you know, how has the team changed? You know, how are there people coming in and out? And I think quite significantly, what is their history in terms of the power unit? You know, what are their sort of track record in getting that right early on in the rules set? I think for me, their power units division and their sort of ability to come out with a fresh set of rules with a competitive package is pretty good. I think they've got a reasonably good history of that. They've had occasions in the past where it's perhaps been a little bit less performant, but they've tended to get up to speed fairly quickly. Perhaps not maybe at the level of Mercedes powertrains, Mercedes HPP, but I think they've been pretty competitive. And I think but the thing for me really is the stability of the team. You know, like Sarah has been in there for a little while now. They've recently just had, I noticed, a change of chief aerodynamicist. So there's a little bit of fluctuation going on at the team. And that for me, it probably means that they will take a little bit of time for that team to bed in. You know, they always seem to be there or thereabouts, Ferrari, but I know that they're desperate to take that next step, aren't they? It's just, I think maybe it'll take a year or two before they really get that team bedded in, would be my feeling.
Well, you can see why they're desperate to take that next step, not only because they're paying Lewis Hamilton a fortune, but because they haven't actually won the Constructors' Championship since 2008, the Kimi Raikkonen and Felipe Massa era. Jake, why not?
I think when you look at Ferrari, it seems always parochial, I think, in that there's not, Dan has already mentioned that Lurk Sarah has come into the team, but you never really see this sort of big transit of, let's say, all of the other teams have the kind of transfer market of moving to maybe different British-based teams and that kind of thing. And you see other teams opening facilities up in the UK to try and capture that transit of engineers and that brain power and that kind of thing. It seems to me that sort of Ferrari has a sort of very relatively rigid kind of team. You sort of see these big changes, let's say post the Schumacher era, you saw this sort of big change in personnel, and then it just sort of very much stayed the same for a very, very long period of time. And then there was sort of maybe another change around the Binotto era, and then it sort of stayed relatively static. And so you're not seeing this sort of vast amount of brain power with different kind of ideas and different thoughts kind of come into the team. It sort of seems kind of set in its ways. And it's kind of strange that it's not won a championship since then, because you go through this era of having Fernando Alonso and Sebastian Vettel and winning races and sort of challenging for championships, but not quite being able to get over the line. But it's just there's always been someone a little bit better. And there's always been a team that's just nailed the rules that little bit more. There's been that team that's perhaps been a little bit more open to trying something a little bit more revolutionary. You look at Ferrari's progress from 2024 to 2025, for example. Weirdly enough, there has been that kind of change in suspension package and change in kind of geometry and opting for something different to try and maybe get a little bit more out of the floor. But it seems to have come a little bit too late. It seems to have kind of jumped on the bandwagon, but only sort of half done it, because it's gone for this sort of, rather than if you're going to fully copy, let's say, McLaren or Red Bull, you'd go for the poor old front push or rear, that sort of thing. Ferrari sort of gone poor old, which packaging wise seems, I think it's sort of a little bit of an enigma. It's not something any other team currently does. Maybe it is trying to go off the beaten track a little bit, but it seems to be kind of, it just seems to be kind of restricting itself and what it can do. It seems to be now and again, you have this suggestion, there's this culture of fear to innovate a little bit. And every now and again, that's kind of opened up and you kind of see Ferrari getting into a position where maybe it can win races and that sort of thing. But it does sort of feel that there's that sort of reticence to kind of innovate a little bit. There's that reticence for people to really feel a little bit free. And when you hear, you know, the spiel at the start of the season that the SF25 was, you know, evolutionary and that sort of thing, it couldn't be anything else, really. I don't know. Ferrari's an enigma. It really is. It doesn't operate like any other Formula One team, I don't think. It sort of seems to be quite siloed in that sort of sense. I feel like maybe it needs sort of fresh way of thinking.
Mm. Well, they're not bringing the magic, that's for sure.
You're listening to the James Allen on F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1 channel.
Well, currently 20 points behind Ferrari in third place in the championship is Mercedes. Now, they dominated F1 for a long time, winning a record 8 consecutive Constructors' Championships between 2014 and 2021. Then the current regulations came in, which changed how the aerodynamics work on the car. And since then, they've not had a sniff. Dan, why do you think they've found these rules so tough to master?
I think they're, you know, like a lot of teams that have a period of success, they are a little bit the victims of that. You know, they weren't sort of internally challenging themselves with something that, you know, didn't correlate, that didn't suit their system. So they had a way of working, which is, you know, almost like a kind of what we used to call a sausage factory. You know, you literally just get everybody working in the same direction, and they're extremely good at putting large amounts of performance on the car in a short space of time. And that was very successful for a long period of time. And it's an incredibly impressive achievement. Let's not beat about the bush. I think when they got to the new regulations, because everybody had to react fairly quickly to particularly the fact that, you know, Red Bull had sort of stumbled on scientific than that. But, you know, Red Bull came across a sort of aerodynamic philosophy which delivered for them fairly quickly, and they got on top of their porpoising also fairly quickly. Mercedes struggled a little bit more to get on top of that, and I think that sort of, you know, stopped the sausage machine running for a little while. So while they sort of rely on this team of people who are just incredibly good at putting downforce on the car, for example, then that sort of got slightly interrupted, and they had to spend a little bit of time you know, reevaluating what they were doing. They obviously, you know, made some changes at the senior level to try and sort of get back into that way of thinking, so that it was a little bit more creative, maybe a little bit less sort of iterative. And I think that's, you know, something maybe they've still struggled with a little bit. They haven't really quite got back into their rhythm again, or if they have, they're, you know, they started from a kind of baseline which was a bit too far back. And I think that's definitely something that they'll be wanting to do again. You know, they've had a few small team changes as they've gone along. So I think they're wanting to consolidate that and just get back into that mode of just, you know, cranking the handle and just, you know, powering forward at a bigger, greater rate than everybody else.
And from what you were saying earlier on, it sounds like you've bought into the idea that with this major rule change, which is engine and chassis, certainly as far as the engine's concerned, you'd expect Mercedes to be the engine to beat next year. Does that give them some hope then that they could be the first post-McLaren team to win the Constructors?
I mean, look, it's really hard to predict. But, you know, there are a lot of challenges with the new power unit, and it's not just about, you know, how good your internal combustion engine is. It's also about, you know, the energy management, the simulation aspects of that. You know, how do you predict when you go into the design phase of your power unit, how do you predict what it is that you're actually going to want out of it? You know, because is it going to be essentially running almost flat out the whole time at a certain RPM, and then you're just, you know, using the energy to fill in the gaps? Or is it going to be far more, you know, far more variable around the lap? You know, what does that mean for the duty cycle, for the reliability aspects of that? I mean, all of that kind of thing has to be almost predicted with your crystal ball before you go into the design phase. So I think the people you'd want to be looking at as who are going to be more successful in terms of the power unit manufacturers is going to be people who have those tools available, who have a good relationship with the team to be able to sort of have those discussions early on. And I think from that aspect, it's very difficult to discount HPP. I think they've got the right links to Mercedes. They've got some very good people in place. They've got a good track record, even though they lost some people, most notably to Red Bull powertrains. I think they've still got a good core of people there, and and as I say, they've got the right sort of techniques and ability to do that sort of big rule change. I think it's. I mean, they're obviously. People like Honda have done great things in the past, but just looking at the other manufacturers, they are, you know, Mercedes, HPP are definitely the standout in terms of hitting the ground running with a new regulation set. And I think with these ones, it's going to be so complicated, that ability will probably stand them in very good stead.
What about for you, Jake? What hope does the new set of regulations offer Mercedes starting next year?
I think the fact that it's not the current regulations, I think that's a good place to start. And I'm sort of, I should be curious to get Dan's opinion on this, because when it came to kind of the start of these regulations, it seemed that obviously you have restrictions in wind speeds and that sort of thing that you can run in the wind tunnels, and everything's kind of, let's say, a little bit less dynamic than it would be on track. So is it perhaps at the start of this regulation set that Mercedes maybe didn't see something in the wind tunnel that it would experience a higher speed? And I'm also sort of curious as well, because they started with the kind of zero pod solution, and we went through various media sessions throughout 22 and 23, and they were like, ah, well, you know, it doesn't work as how we hoped. And I always wondered why, what they were trying to get out of that. First of all, I guess the wind tunnel sort of question, would it perhaps be something that they hadn't seen at the start of the regulation set and then struggled to kind of get on top of?
I mean, I think it's difficult to simplify it too much, but I think the point about the zero pod that they tried is with these regulations, it became quite obvious early on that it's very difficult to find rear downforce on the car. One of the best things you can do is just to improve as much of the flow as you can, just give as much good, clean flow to the back of the car, and that gives you a fighting chance of being able to do something useful with it. The sort of zero pod solution was very much about that. And I think early on, a lot of teams found that the more air you could deliver to the rear of the car, the more potential you had. But with the front of the floor and the front wing and everything else, there's plenty of available ability to put downforce on the front of the car. So I think they very much prioritized that. The thing that Red Bull found, which, you know, eventually everybody else has gone with, is actually there's a huge amount of performance in the floor if you can use the bodywork to support that. And then as a compounding factor, what then happened, which I don't think anybody predicted, even though they might say in hindsight that they did, I would call that out, is that, you know, then this sort of oscillation, this load oscillation, the porpoising, which then everybody saw. And the problem about that is it's not an exclusively an aerodynamic phenomenon. It's about a it's a platform control thing. So it's about the way the floor generates its load, and it's about how you then deal with that with the suspension. So if teams have then found something which is better at managing the downforce on the floor, and you've gone down a route which is more about, you know, delivering efficient airflow to the back of the car, they are potentially, or I think as Mercedes found, they are slightly mutually exclusive. So they then had to sort of reverse on that philosophy and then go down more of the route of concentrating on delivering consistent downforce to the floor, you know, stability of the flow through that. And then that allowed them to, you know, to keep the porpoising again under control. But it is difficult. I mean, it's the same thing. It'll happen next year as well. People will go down a route believing that that's, you know, that's what they need to do to be able to sort of optimize these regs. And then you get to a certain point and realize that actually that's a bit of a dead end, and what somebody else has chosen is the right way. It's easy to be quite smug about that if you've chosen the correct direction. But sometimes it comes down to a coin toss. You know, you can really just say, we're not really sure which one of these is going to deliver. Let's guess and go down that one and hope for the best.
And what about Red Bull then? They've been the most successful team under this set of regulations, winning 2022 and 2023. Does last weekend, Laurent Mekies' first victory as a Red Bull Racing Team principal, does it show that they've got some promise for the future, or are they just heavily reliant on Max Verstappen, Jake?
I think it's going to rely on power unit, isn't it? And that's one of the key things that it's going to hinge on. And actually, Laurent Mekies was asked this over the Monza weekend, and he said, you know, it'd be silly to say that it's going to be at the top of its game off the bat, because having to develop an entirely new powertrains project, having to get all of the people in place, having to build something from fresh that other teams and other manufacturers have had for years and years and years, that's a hugely difficult task to do. And you've got to integrate everybody, and you've got to start from nothing. You don't have a kind of standard to live up to. You've kind of got to set something. It's really, really difficult to do that off the bat. Yes, I suppose there was some kind of a little bit of carryover from Honda when Honda sort of pulled out but didn't. But again, this is developing something from scratch, not maintaining something that already exists. There's lots of things coming at Red Bull though. There's the new wind tunnel that's coming in, which I think they're very, very hopeful about. There's this sort of renewed feeling of optimism, I think. Bringing Mekies in as team principal, I think it just sort of says to kind of everybody, okay, we've had a hugely successful two decades. Now, you know, let's do something different. Because clearly performance was regressing over the last year or so. I think there's this sense of optimism that's sort of coming back, all of this shiny new stuff that everybody wants to try out. And it's going to take a long time for, you know, wind tunnel commissioning and for calibration, that kind of thing to happen. I can't remember when it should come on. It's either next year or the year after that it comes online. But I think going down the road, it might not be immediately successful for the team, but you reach a point of kind of, I guess, critical mass where everything kind of snowballing into where you want it. The powertrain's coming online, the aerodynamics are getting better and better, and you don't have all of these correlation issues that they're currently having. Maybe 2026 will be a difficult season, but I think going beyond that, they should be in a much better place for sure.
I was told a couple of months ago, by a very reliable source in the middle of all that scene, that they reckon they'd be, very hard to say, but there is a lot of chat amongst all the community of engine builders, as you know. And I remember in 2014, as we approached 2014, you could get a pretty accurate read on that it was going to be Mercedes that was going to be the best. I was told they reckon they'll be a couple of tenths off on the engine side next year. And if you consider that Alpine is probably about, what, 0.3, 0.35 down at the moment, you look at what that does to their performance, then, you know, it gives you a bit of an idea of what Red Bull might be like next year. But of course, you've also then got the complexity of the aerodynamic changes coming in as well, which makes it very, very hard to predict who's going to go well. But Dan, looking at you, I mean, your old team, you were hugely successful in your time at Red Bull. Do you see the magic coming back there? I mean, do you feel that Laurent, is, as Jake said, is going to just basically just steer a different era, be given the time to build it, and how long do you think it'll take before they win again?
I mean, I think the thing about Red Bull is their technical team is very strong. You know, they have that ability to be able to kind of get a new car to the level it needs to be pretty quickly. And I think, you know, they demonstrated in this last rule set that they're able to innovate and follow a concept through to its completion, which I think is really important for the new regs from an aerodynamic point of view. The other thing is they're very good at is that they, I think a lot of their departments work very well together from a technical point of view. You know, they have an incredible, you know, kind of manufacturing capability, which can turn things around very quickly, but they also very good at communicating. That's typically in the past meant that their greatest strength is sort of in-season development. I think the reason they were so dominant at the beginning of this rule set is because they also managed to nail the initial concept. But particularly when I was there, one of the things we found that probably more frustrating is our ability to really sort of launch with a great car was not as great as some other people. But the sort of in-season development was very, very strong. So I think that's what I would be looking to them to do again. I think they have that ability. The team is very much set up to do that. So if the power unit is slightly down on power, and I think, you know, realistically, given the magnitude of the task they undertook to get to the point where they can produce power unit for 26, I mean, it's a phenomenal undertaking. You know, given there was absolutely nothing when, you know, just shortly before I left Red Bull, there was absolutely nothing. There was no, you know, there was no building, let alone anywhere to put a power unit or test it. So to go from that to where they are now, it would be phenomenal if they're there or thereabouts in terms of their power unit performance. But if they're not quite there, you know, we haven't talked about it, but there is going to be this sort of equalization of power, we believe, that's going to come in at some point. I'm not personally not sure how that's going to work. Maybe it is clearer to the teams, but that's obviously something that could work for their benefit. And I think they're a team that even if they don't come out of, you know, out of the starting blocks in first place, I think you wouldn't bet against them to catch up pretty quickly. And I think that's what they'll be looking for. They'll be looking for, you know, to make sure that they get something which is solid enough as a base, but, you know, perhaps not expecting to be sort of championship material straight away, but looking to forge their way up as quickly as possible. And I think on the power unit equalization thing, I think that's going to be a very interesting thing to keep an eye out for, because if, you know, the majority of the manufacturers are all on the same level, and then you've got one outlier like we have now, perhaps, that's something that's much easier to equalize. But if you've got somebody who is quite dominant on the power unit and everybody else is struggling, I would imagine they'll be extremely reluctant to allow that to happen. So, and again, I'm not quite sure what the mechanism is or how that's going to work for equalizing that, but that's something we need to keep an eye out for, because that, I imagine there'll be a lot of chat about that beginning of next year.
I think the other thing with Red Bull, of course, is, you know, the most, as they say in Formula One, the most important nut on a Formula One car is the one who holds the wheel. And keeping Max Verstappen in the team will be a huge challenge, I think, beyond the end of 2026. So the big part of their calculus will be, who do they get to lead that team going forward? Because I would certainly put money on him not being a Red Bull driver in 2027. Finally, then, are there any outsiders that we haven't mentioned yet who could be the first post-McLaren Constructors champion? What about Aston Martin, for example, with an Adrian Newey-designed Honda-powered car? What do you reckon to that, Jake? Are they got a shout? What about anybody else that we're not thinking about?
It's going to be interesting, actually, because I think this is the first time that it's going to be a works team and you have a Honda in the back, and Honda's been incredibly good since it tied up with Red Bull. So it'd be really interesting to see, because it's sort of, I think it felt wanted by the kind of Red Bull family that year at Toro Rosso in 2018. They said, you know what, you can bring updates to every single race if you want. You know, we'll take the grid penalties, it's fine. It'd probably be worth it at the end. I'd be interested to see how it sort of gets the ball rolling with this regulation, because it almost had to start from scratch again, didn't it? Because it lost a sort of quite a few people to the Red Bull project. And again, I think a lot is made about having Adrian Newey in the team, but again, it might take a few years to get up and running. The other cut teams, plural, that I'd like to enter into the conversation for this, the dark horses perhaps, but Williams, for example, I think a huge amount of progression for this season. You're starting to see the kind of the revolution and the changes bear quite a lot of fruit. This big modernization effort to get it on the level with where perhaps a Formula One team circa 2025 should be, rather than, I think, what James Vowles was saying, antique machinery in the background, something that could feasibly end up on Antiques Roadshow, that sort of thing. And the other one, perhaps weirdly enough, Alpine, Mercedes powertrains. And if we're talking about Mercedes having potentially the best powertrain for 2026, it's got the ball rolling there. And there is this big recovery effort going on. I mean, there's been endless changes of personnel, but surely they've got to hit the right note at some point. And the reason I bring them up is because Pierre Gasly has just signed a long-term contract. I think what, within 1 week of Steve Nielsen being team principal, that's got to be a sign of encouragement, right? The fact that he's kind of thrown his lot in without even looking at the 2026 car, without even having driven it, and he's gone, you know what, I'll stay here for another few years. So I'm happy to do that. Clearly he's encouraged by the results and the signs that he's seen in the background. Maybe he just didn't have any other options, but surely you'd wait, you'd do him Verstappen and wait to see what the 2026 car is like before securing your future. So potentially, you know, he's encouraged by it.
What are your thoughts, Dan, on the other possible contenders?
Yeah, I agree with Jake on Williams. I think that's a really good shout. I think they are a team that's been maybe not quite so quietly, but they've been sort of relatively quietly, you know, kind of getting on with making some improvements. They've hired some very good people there. You know, I think James Vowles has got a good handle on what they need to do. I'm not sure, you know, how their finances are, because it's, you know, I'm sure he understands what the ambition is and what he wants to do. It's just whether they've got the money to do it in terms of the capital investment. And those things do take time as well. So it's whether they're, you know, sufficiently far down the journey to be able to make that step. But I like what I've seen from them. I think they're making some good, sensible progress. They've got some very good people there. So I think that's a good outside shout. Yeah, and I think that they'd probably be my kind of, I guess. I think it's, even though it's a big rule change, it's very difficult for teams that aren't, you know, kind of in that sort of top echelon at the moment. It's very difficult for them to carry on. And it's not just about, you know, momentum, because clearly it's very, very different for next year. It's about the sort of processes and the tools and things they have. It's the boring stuff in the background, which, you know, doesn't get celebrated so much, but makes a huge amount of difference. The way that, you know, some of the departments communicate with each other, they, you know, the way they're helped. I mean, it's under a pretty restrictive cost cap system at the moment, which means that, you know, some of the other aspects of the team can really, really help the engineering groups to get to where they need to go. So, you know, all of those things are very well sorted in the, you know, the Mercedes, the McLarens of the world, and some of the other teams are simply just on the journey to get there. And I think that does hurt you when you're coming into a new regulation set and trying to be that competitive. So I think we've been talking about the right people, is my view. You know, I think if you look at McLaren, they've just got a very good, very well communicating team that seems to be able to deliver a huge amount of performance. So I think they'll be they're going to be very tough to beat. And I think, you know, the Mercedes and Ferraris are the ones that we should be talking about.
Yeah, I spoke to Lando Norris earlier this summer and said, do you feel that this is your best shot at winning a world champion? Do you feel extra pressure because, you know, one of you is going to win this world championship? And do you feel like you've got to get it done this year? And he said, no, quite the reverse, actually. I look at what we've got in the pipeline for next year, and I actually think that we've got plenty more chances to win the Drivers' World Championship. Now, of course, you would say that, wouldn't you, if you're in his shoes, because you don't want to put the pressure on yourself. But the way he said it was interesting. And you may well be right, Dan, that you know, they're feeling pretty confident. They've certainly got the right engine in the back if Mercedes come up with the goodies. You know, they are well set. But finally then, gents, it's prediction time. And I'll hold you to this, however many years it takes before someone else wins the Constructors' Championship. Who will win the first post-McLaren F1 Constructors' Championship? Dan, what's your guess?
I'm going to go for Mercedes. And I think that's because they've, as an organisation, they've been hurting for this regulation set. And I think they've probably realised within the last year or two that their best chance now is to you know, finish off this regulation set, but really focus on 26. I think they are an absolute awesome force to be reckoned with. And I think they've slightly sort of kept themselves out of the conversation over the last couple of years, even though, you know, and it's been more about the drivers and, you know, how Kimi's getting on and so on. I think when they see this as a big opportunity, and they will have put a huge amount of effort into it. And when they really get going, they are very, very difficult to stop. So yes, I think McLaren incredibly impressive, and I think they've got a great team at the moment, but you know, hell hath no fury like a F1 team scorned, and that, I think, yeah, I'm going to go with Mercedes.
How about you, Jake?
I was going to say Mercedes as well, perhaps not quite so eloquently as Dan. So I'll be different and say Ferrari, just because I sort of feel like there is something bubbling there. I think, you know, this season has very much been an exploration and a journey of why doesn't this car work perhaps as well as we want it to, but we'll keep developing it anyway, because that's how you keep your tools modernized. That's how you keep your sim tools well calibrated and that kind of thing. We don't know what the powertrain is going to be like, because it's been sort of kept relatively quiet. We speak about Mercedes having a very, very good one. We speak perhaps about some of the others, potentially Audi, for example, being a little bit behind. We don't really know where Ferrari is. I'm going to take no news as good news and suggest that Charles Leclerc's finally going to get his chance to win the championship. But I think it could be any one of about three or four teams.
Fantastic. Well, that will do us. My thanks to Dan Fallows. Check out his insightful work on Race Tech. That's with a Q, T-E-Q, where he's written some really good stuff looking ahead to the 2026 cars, and also on his Substack. My thanks also to Jake. You can read all his F1 work on the Autosport and Motorsport channels. Remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllen on F1 on X. My thanks to producer Ben, and thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe, leave us a review and a rating, and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We'll be back with another podcast very soon.
You've been listening to the James Allen on F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, check out the Autosport F1 channel, wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify.